the start by discussing the party tradition towards establishment of bourgeois democracies across the world. You know, if, as you say, that you think of bourgeois democracy is the centre of establishing socialism, we've had this issue in the party now for some time, that where we stand on that issue, do we support the establishment of bourgeois democracy across the world? And specifically, to affect Gandhi now, if our comrade are facing the difficulties which they finally are, then does that mean that we are going to see Article 3 and social standards saying that we support the establishment of democracy in Uganda and other states in Africa? I mean, we had that issue about 10 years back with Poland, where Article 3 and the standard where we supported the establishment of democracy there. The party members feel that we should in fact come out more openly and supporting the establishment of the democracy across the world.
Well, we've always supported the establishment of democracy where it doesn't exist, because we recognise that without it, the prospects for the growth of socialism in those countries that don't have it are nil. I mean, how can you have the growth of the socialist movement in a situation where you're not allowed to organise politically? Of course we do. That doesn't mean to say we're going to support the likes of the so-called national liberation movements, because we know that what they're after is just a continuation of capitalism, only for different masters. Get rid of the colonial masters and be replaced by their local equivalents. So we're not in favour of the national liberation movements. And we've seen how national liberation movements have ended up. I thought I'd made that clear in the course of my talk, that where the national liberation movements have taken over almost everywhere, it has ended up in either a one-party state or a military dictatorship. So democracy is necessary, but we don't say it's got to be established everywhere in the world. I mean, this is an old argument that the party has faced down the years, and it could be summed up this way. I mean, objections to the party case could be summed up as, you know, what about the lazy man, what about the greedy man, what about human nature, and another one could be, what do we have to wait for the last Hottentot? And the answer to that one is no, we don't. That's not what we're saying at all. We're saying that when the time comes when sufficient of the world's population is democratically organised and the socialist movements have taken over there, then that will be sufficient. If there's other parts of the world which as yet aren't fully aware of the socialist case, I don't see how that could be, incidentally, in the light of the technological revolution that we have today, because, you know, the talk about the global village has got some truth in it. Information is so easily accessible today that it's impossible to believe there's other parts of the world where they wouldn't know about it. I mean, could we, for example, have socialism in this country and yet 20 miles away across the English Channel, the workers in France and Belgium and places like that would not also be wanting socialism? Because if we're right and socialism is a response to the problems of capitalism, and that's why we got it here, then the same conditions exist over there, therefore the same response would be there. So we don't see, but nevertheless, we can't associate ourselves with left-wing groups. We get tabbed with the same brush. So our case for democracy is different from their case for democracy. We see democracy as being the doorway, if you like, to something better, to a social society. They don't.
Is that Paddy for that? It is, isn't it? Come on, Paddy.
True, we always support the acquisition of greater democratic rights in our country because of the reasons of our rights. Is it therefore logically followed that we always oppose movements to take those rights away again? And the reason I'm asking for it, because a couple of years ago in this country we had the protest against the Criminal Justice Bill,
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't recall the party at that time
Criminal Justice
they completely having any kind of statement, unequivocal statement against the CJB at that time. As I say, you may correct me if I'm wrong, but we don't, it seems to me, we don't seem to take the logical corollary, which is that we always oppose the situation where those rights are being taken away again.
And he's suggesting that we should have, for example, supported the case against, or rather the case, the case against that bill you're talking about. Should we have? Is that what you're saying?
I'm asking.
You're asking? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, because we don't get involved in the debates about how best capitalism should be run. We don't want capitalism with the criminal
Criminal Justice Bill.
The Criminal Justice Bill, or without the Criminal Justice Bill. We just want rid of capitalism, full stop. That's what we want. So we don't get involved in all these reformist movements who want 101 ways which they think will in some way mitigate or lessen the awfulness of capitalism. We don't do that. We leave that to them. Let those who want to run the capitalist system, let them do it.
Yes, Vince.
Yes, just related to this issue of whether or not we should be involved in protecting the very limited democratic rights that have been gained in countries like this, or whether we should be campaigning or not for essential democracy on behalf of the world. Of course, there are lots of ways in which the position of working class could at least in a temporary and very limited way be improved under capitalism, although we know very well that it would be only temporary and it would be only very limited. But our task as a socialist party is because we're, well, for one thing, we're only a fairly small organisation anyway, and because we are a socialist party, our real concern is about the establishment of socialism and not to dissipate our energies by getting involved in various campaigns to try and, in some limited way, make capitalism just slightly less intolerable for the working class, because we know that
if I might chip in here, I think what's happening here with the question and answer issue is that the last two speakers are trying to say, surely, and I'm not speaking for them, surely there is a difference in kinds between an amelioration of the effects of capitalism and a reform or the maintenance of so-called rights which make it more straightforward to form a socialist movement and work for socialism. It seems to me they're saying that, and I think that's slightly different, or at least they're asking the question, is it different? Richard, carry on.
Can we be a bit more specific then about something which I indicated in my talk I don't consider a reform, which is collection of the franchise, which I don't consider a reform because it is fundamental to the needs for a democratic socialism. So it is so fundamental, one person, one vote, it is hardly a reform. Now, supposing this takes place in a country and that right is then taken away, the position then must surely logically be a party that we would take issue with that, because then here is something taken away which is fundamental to our position. And I'm not quite clear about what the party thinks about that, though I have my own view, as I indicated. It is a specific thing, and I agree with what you say about the things within that. Once they've got that, what happens there about reforms within that system is not something we deal with. But the actual basic granting of one person, one vote, seems to be a different case altogether.
Yeah.
Do you want to answer that first? Or Christopher's got his hand up. Which do you want to do?
No, I'll take notes.
You take notes. Christopher.
Yeah, I was just wanting to add to that the Criminal Justice Bill is one to a reform of the capitalist system, ameliorating the system itself, as the argument was. That we should do nothing to do that because it lessens the chance of creating socialism at the end. Then you could add to that, what about the freedom of information? You know, if you actually talk about freedom of information, are we actually saying then that a freedom of information bill that actually allows many secret documents to become public into the public realm is not an aid to the movement towards socialism? That it could be that this is an instrument which we could use to advantage rather than just leaving and saying, oh, well, they're not doing it, you know, that's their problem, it's nothing to do with us. We're going to wait till it all happens, and then we'll work for a socialist commonwealth. See, when it's all come about, but it won't come about unless we're willing to work for it.
Just before that, then, Dick, I must admit I've forgotten it now, and it's Paddy, can you just give us the bare bones of it?
The Criminal Justice Bill takes away it's arguable what it does. It reinforces some rules that the police already did anyway, but it extends the franchise of the police to break up elite gatherings of more than four people. So if you go and have a party of five people or a barbecue on a beach, you can get arrested. Now, to me, what Richard said about there is a difference between reform and basic fundamental democratic rights. The right of free assembly, the right of free speech, is a basic fundamental right.
I didn't really ask you to do that. I only asked for the information.
CJ, well, this is what worries me, that are we not losing the plot here? That there was an attack very recently on democratic rights in Britain, and nobody here seems to be even aware of it very clearly.
Okay, thank you. Richard.
We're at the very front. Well, we are aware of it. It's just a wee while ago, isn't it? And there's that many of them. I mean, like, what about that one, the freedom of information? What about this one? What about that one? There's not a day goes by that there's not an issue that somebody could say, oh, well, this really directly, because we live in an interrelated world, so an interrelated society, this directly deals with the possibility of a social change. But we're a socialist party whose aim is to get world socialism. It's not like all these other organisations to make the running of capitalism a bit smoother. Now, the point about it is some of these may be worthwhile. Quite often, what they're all clamouring for, oh yes, you must support this, is often injurious. I mean, we can think of family allowance, we can think of all other sort of things. Demonstrations against certain taxation, and even capitalism is so complicated in its reformist nature that is a road down which we certainly shouldn't contemplate going. Now, on this proposition about the Socialist Party acting democratically, I mean, I'll give you an example. We don't have to go to the Gambia. Some years ago, before Edinburgh branch, in fact, it's quite a few years ago. Before Edinburgh branch were formed, the Glasgow branch used to have meetings every Sunday in the Mound. And we were approached by one of the organisations who said, they're talking about making this a car park. So everybody that uses this, we want you all to sign a petition and we're going to present this to the council. So we said, no, you know. I said, first of all, we want to know the details. And then our branch will decide what to do about it. I said, I can tell you right now that we are not going to sign a petition along with, this would you be by the campaign for nuclear disarmament, which, it was never part of our remit. Secondly, and this is a cracker, the Protestant Action League, who spend all their time attacking the Catholic Church. I mean, in other words, what we would say, and the only thing a socialist can say is, yes, it would help us democratically to be able to speak at this corner. Yes, we will protest about it, but no, we won't combine with these people who only accept democracy when it bloody well suits them anyway. Well, we're not going to. And I think it's important as a political party that we make that distinction. And I think it's absolutely essential. I can't remember the details now, but I'm sure there was a leaflet. In fact, there was an article as well pointing out certain flaws of the movement to try and repeal that bill, which I can't remember the intricacies on that at the moment. But it's a very, very dangerous road to go down. I mean, I know, for instance, Paddy was talking when he was up in Glasgow about free the streets, let people take over the streets and so on and that, which I always thought was a daft thing. The workers have already got the streets. I thought somebody's get something a wee bit better than that. But nevertheless, and we saw it recently, which the newspapers depicted as a campaign against capitalism. It wasn't a campaign against capitalism, of course, although the organisers might have said it was such. It was a sort of fairy from a party, a street party, to a riot, depending where you were. And should the party get involved in that? Definitely not. I mean, who are the people that are engaged in that? Do we want to be associated with people who think the answer to social problems is breaking up things or disrupting people going to their work? Is this what we've got to get? So I think it's absolutely essential, yes, be in favour of trying to get as much as you can for the working class as regards democracy, but don't associate with these ragbagger outfits who are not really in favour of a democracy, far less socialism. So I think you should make that distinction.
Bert, and then, I'm not sure who was first, but I'm going to roll Bert and then Toby.
Yeah. Speaking, been talking about democracy and government and so on, but wouldn't you agree that nowadays a lot of the power is in the the big companies like Shell, Monsanto, arms trade companies and so on?
You want to take that now, or shall I take the next one as well?
And that often overrides the power of the governments themselves.
Well, Dick mentioned the forms of capitalism which we could be, and were, urged to participate in, and say that some of the things that were proposed were actually worse than what had gone before. And a good example of that was in the last, 10 years now, was the poll tax. Remember the fuss about that? It was likely some members thought that the party should join in the protest about the poll tax. And what was the outcome? Okay, the poll tax went, and what happened? It got replaced by something called the council tax, in which case a hell of a lot of people actually found themselves worse off than they had been under the poll tax. And on the question of you've got to watch who you associate yourself with, way back in the 1930s, the big issue at the time, and it was dealt with in the columns of the Socialist Standard regularly, was the Popular Front. Surely we were told, you must join with all those democratic organisations that have come together, okay, not for socialism, but in order to keep fascism at bay. Incidentally, who was among them? The communists. Were they democrats? Were they interested in defending democracy? No, of course they weren't. So we couldn't possibly unite with them. And in any case, there was never any chance that the Popular Front was going to succeed. I mean, how can you get all these people with such divergent views together to achieve anything? So the Popular Front, of course, collapsed. Now, do the big companies have power? Well, of course they've got some power. I thought I'd made that point clear. Yes, they have got power, but not as much as some people might imagine. I gave examples of how the lobbyists have got great success in getting things published, or rather put into legislation to bring about things that the big companies want, and also bring about legislation to repeal things that the companies don't want. But it all depends on the balance of forces within the capitalism at any particular time. But if capitalism decides that it would be better to resist the big companies of a particular industry, then it will do so. Now, for all the clout that the tobacco industry's got, has it saved them from all the legislation that's been passed, making life difficult for them and cutting into their profits and so on? You know, this one that the left wing always come up with about power being in the boardrooms. I mean, why is it then, if that's the case, that the CBI and the Institute of Directors are forever howling with rage at the things that governments do to them? Both Tory and Labour governments have passed legislation which has had the CBI and Institute of Directors tearing their hair out. They put up taxes. They increase interest rates, things which business definitely does not want. So, okay, they're powerful up to a point. But as I say, they're not nearly as powerful as people think they are. To a great extent, they are paper tigers. They have some success. Just recently there, well, what was this? It's more than that, it's 1994, time flies, when the Republicans gained control of both the Senate and the Congress, and Michael Moore deals with this in his book. They immediately set about dismantling some of the legislation that had been passed by previous administrations. But as I say, it all depends on the balance of forces on capitalism at a particular time. The tide will turn, probably, and in the future, without our help, the legislation will never come back again. So big companies have power, but, you know, not ultimate power. Politicians have got that, and that power comes from us. We're the ones who, in the final analysis, have got the power, if we would only use it.
Toby?
Well, I was glad that that question previously expanded the range of things we were talking about. I think the discussion we were having before is a useful discussion to have, but perhaps a functional than here. My question is about something that Vic said at the beginning of this talk. We were talking this morning about storytelling, and there's a story that we tell very well in the party, and Vic said this himself. It's three words. What he said was, capitalism needs democracy. And that's one of these things that we say. In my experience, we don't actually think about what that means. It's one of the things we just make an assumption about. We tell people that. Is it actually true, though? I was wondering what the feelings of people in this room are on that. And the reason that I was thinking about this is because we have another story that we tell as well, which is about, say, what happened in Russia. And we say that what happened in Russia in 1917, and we've got all sorts of quotations from Vladimir himself to prove it. What actually happened there was that there was a capitalist revolution, but of course it was brought about by a dictatorship. And we say, well, look what happened. There was the electrification of the Soviet Union. All of these vast tracts of land in Europe and Asia were developed much more quickly than they would ever have been otherwise. And yet that was done at the barrel of a gun. That was done by slave labor. Isn't there a contradiction there of saying, well, dictatorship could bring capitalism about very quickly, very efficiently in the Soviet Union, and yet on the other hand, the other story we tell is that capitalism needs democracy. And is this just an excuse actually for complacency? What we say to ourselves is, well, of course, all of these lefties, they talk about the danger that democracy's in, but we know it's going to be all right, really. We know that Providence will see us through in the end, because capitalism needs democracy. We don't need to worry about it too much. Which of these stories is actually the right one, or can we reconcile them? I'm not sure that we can, but I'd be interested to see what other people have to say.
Simon?
I'd like to come back on that and say that capitalism is usually strongest when you have a wide variety of capitalist democracy in terms of, you know, what they call free democracy. Capitalist democracy, if you like, let's call it that, tends to be strongest at the point where you have a complex economy with lots of things going on, different sections of the economy. Whereas what you'll find is, for example, if you've got, say, a country which consists of a mine, a road and a port, and one company basically owns the country, then you're just going to have the place run at the, you know, conflict. Now, you're not going to have much of a democracy there. And it's a similar thing if you've got lots of big, like, developments of capital, you know, that require state involved to a great extent. Those sort of things that in the previous century, in the 19th century, the electrification or whatever, the construction of railways, all being done through states, and they were managing them. Yeah? They were done during the first half of the 20th century in Russia through the state. Yeah? And because you didn't have this diversity, because it was all like these major, you know, investments that weren't really available. You couldn't do them with private capital. That's why you had state involvement in the first place. That's why you've got different different approaches in terms of whether you have capitalist democracy or not. That's what I think.
Anyone else want to come in on that? Sorry, at the back. John, yes.
I think it is, especially in the United States, where we see this great shift now to the power of lobbyists, showing that the political state at the moment, the democracy, the representative democracy, is getting weaker and weaker. And all the power is so blatant now in the United States, the tobacco lobbyists and so on. Not quite about 2 years ago, we had a very progressive congressman of Central Ohio. He came on the floor, and he had a handful of checks. He says, "Fellas, it's pay time. All of you that were supporting that bill for the tobacco company, they've paid off. See me in the cloakroom and I'll give you your checks." That's straight out. There was no whip or anything. That guy has gone bad. As a matter of fact, he's a Republican leader, a Congressman Bowman. They accepted the United States for that. And this is the point, that the capitalists now, they don't trust political democracy then. Why then do they have these huge lobbyists? It's obvious. Massive amounts of money. Especially in elections. And this is where we are today. And all the liberals are crying now. Oh, we have to have election reform. And it is so blatant. Clinton, who is the most notorious for this, he got Chinese, everybody involved to collect money. And now he says, oh, I want election reform. After he can no longer run. So I take the position that the political state is getting less and less. I'm not saying we do away with political democracy, but the real threat to political democracy in the United States today, the power of the lobbyists, and people seeming acceptance of it.
Well, I hinted at that in the introductory first page on this, but nobody up until now has taken it up. Yes, Peter?
There's no doubt about it. If we look around the world and speak, Chairman, you'll notice that the most advanced countries in every respect in terms of production, in institutions and standards of living and this sort of thing, are those countries which have well-entrenched liberal democracies. So it is therefore very difficult to resist the idea that there is a connection between successful capitalist states and liberal democratic political institutions. And I think that's the case. There are all sorts of measures I think you can use about this, but there is one useful one, I think, and that is the rate of productivity. You will find that you have had a huge rate of productivity in those countries where you get liberal democracies. They are the countries where you have development at its fastest pace, with the proliferation of products, development of markets, and all the things that go with it. The case of Russia has been cited, which successfully industrialized under a dictatorship, but don't forget, that did eventually collapse. And one of the things that caused it to collapse was this very question of productivity. In the first place, Russia diverted massive resources of capital into armaments and military, and that was a complete distortion of it as a capitalist state. And one of the consequences was this extremely low rate of productivity, which kept the standards of living very poor. You've got a completely demoralized working class, and the whole thing ground to a halt. In India, you've got a democracy up to a point, and they're developing very, very rapidly. The only exception, I think, is China, where they do have a dictatorship. There is not democracy there, but they are developing incredibly fast at this time. But then in China, they've been shrewd enough to allow the development of the free market at a very fast pace. And my prediction would be that hand in hand with that, sometime in the relative near future, they will also have the development of democratic institutions. There is one thing that you, one other good reason why developed capitalist states need democracy, and that is because the arguments that take place between the capitalists themselves, and none of them want any other section of the capitalist class to have a great whole share of power at the expense of the other. And one of the ways that this can be balanced out is through having political democratic institutions. An example of an economy that got completely and hopelessly distorted through crass dictatorship was Romania, if you remember. People in that country were completely ground down, and you had this ghastly Ceausescu with his family and all his cronies. They were just sucking, you know, all the benefits of the corruption system out there. But of course, that didn't last long, and the bastard got what he just deserves. But the lesson was that the operation of that dictatorship in that particular country led to a complete distortion of the development of the capitalist system there. And that is another example of the reason why the existence of democratic institutions and stable and even capitalist development tend to go hand in hand.
I'd like, well, can I have a go on this myself? I'll try to be brief. I think that Peter Lawrence, the last speaker, was expressing a wish rather than a statement. And I think he failed to distinguish between emerging capitalist countries and what I would call submerging capitalist countries. That's to say, I see the granting of democracy as being a capitalist ploy which suited them for a while. The point is that it turned out, has turned out to be greatly disappointing for the world's industrialized working class. And both in the States and in Europe, including Britain, voting figures are going down and down. They are quite concerned about it. As you say, it would suit them to have a popular mandate for whatever they were doing. But the mandate is ceasing to exist. Now, this is getting almost as bad as it was in an early capitalist country, that's to say, Germany in the 30s, relatively new capitalist country, where people threw away democracy because it was not producing the goods. Now, the opposite seems to be happening now. What seems to be happening is that the working class of Britain and America, say, are getting, at least a large section of them, the goods, and they're concerned more about what they can consume than whether they've got any political control or not. In fact, they can see they've got no political control. Now, this seems to me to be where the danger is. That's to say, for considerable time in the future, we shall go on having these sham elections. They may even follow the Australian model and force people to vote, and it will look as though there is a consensus or there is a democracy in favour of them. But in fact, it will have almost no validity whatsoever. However, I won't speak anymore. You've spoken, Bert, and I'll try and keep it to people who haven't spoken first.
Sure. Can I just very quickly?
No, Bert, you can't. No, you can't, Bert. No, you can't. You cannot do it. You will either move me out of the chair or you will accept my ruling.
I accept
it. There was one over here. What? No, it's gone.
I raised my arm.
Did you? Sorry, yes, go on.
But you rather made the point that I...
I beg your pardon.
I wanted to... You mentioned the fact that at least on one occasion in this century, workers have thrown away democracy. You mentioned Nazi Germany as an example where a liberal democracy, the Weimar Republic, was voted out of office largely... where you had these competing dictatorial parties. On the one hand, the National Socialists and Nazis. On the other hand, the communists and the nationalists in between. And to a great extent, the workers of Germany committed political suicide by supporting these parties. There was another example that I was going to cite, was Czechoslovakia, immediately after the last World War, where I understand that the Communist Party was actually voted into power and then clamped down in its typical dictatorial fashion on the working population of that country. So it isn't always the case, I think, that capitalism needs democracy. I would like to amend that phrase to capitalism prefers democracy, because while I agree with Peter that it does seem that under a liberal government or a liberal capitalism in any one country, the process of exploitation, as far as the capitalists are concerned, proceeds more efficiently. They are quite willing to do business under certain circumstances with dictatorial parties, if it means that their ends can be achieved. And then it becomes a question of selling it to the workers of that particular country. And, you know, Germany in the 30s, I think, is an outstanding example of how workers gave up rights that they had in favour of concentration camps and authoritarianism.
There was some across here. Dear, dear, dear. I didn't take it out of everybody else's mouth, did I? Right, Bert, nobody else wants to speak.
Okay, thank you. Just generally, Australia's been mentioned a few times today, and that it's compulsory to vote. I think you can actually register at the election, whatever it's called, without voting, but I mean, as long as you register, you don't actually have to vote. So I understand.
Thank you. Stan, yes?
I don't think we've answered the very difficult question of what we do as socialists about democracy. When democracy is threatened, when there is a movement to put it back, I think that Paddy started, you know, what could have been a discussion along those lines when he mentioned the criminal justice bill. And I think that then someone a bit later mentioned Reclaim the Streets. My, not just mine, but I think the dilemma is that to get socialism, there must be a considerable measure of democracy. On the other hand, we don't want to spend our time supporting a movement, for example, which will oppose the introduction of the criminal justice bill. I don't think we want to associate at all, or certainly not very actively, with Reclaim the Streets and a number of other, very large number of organizations, groups, etc., which are seeking some change in capitalism. To me, it's a real dilemma, because I repeat, to get socialism, we must have a considerable measure of democracy. Dilemma. When that is threatened, what do we do about it?
You have spoken, Christopher. Let me try and take people who haven't. Come on, Henry.
Just one point. In the development of the argument that the comment raised over there about industrialization of Russia and so on, you get the feeling that I'll ever get something out of it that this was something good. And a lot of this depends on how you look at it, the sense that how was it good? Because the other capitalists wouldn't see that as particularly good if Russia has developed, there's a competitor to them. And of course, the Russians obviously developed their own country, but they could only develop it in accordance to how they could operate and what was already existing against them. But I mean, at the end of the war, the Japanese found herself in certain markets and became very good at it. But that was because other markets were not there. They had to develop new markets. And so this whole question, you know, of developed markets and all that, from a worker's point of view, it's only good for him if he sees himself getting a job out of it, getting wages out of it, and he supports the government or parties that are going to involve him in the hope that he's going to see himself all right by supporting getting a wage out. But like I say, nationalist groups are tremendously telling you to get in, we run the country, you, the Scotsman or the Irishman or whoever, will be better off in this particular environment because your natural going to be running the place and so on. So these sort of ideas are often put up, you know, in so-called democratic ways and so on. But at the end of the day, the developments that are taking place are only what's available in that particular part of the world. But if they find themselves getting too much competition in one area, eventually, you know, it comes a slump and all that, as far as you're concerned and so on, have to develop new markets. So I'm not too happy with the idea that we say there's something wonderful about this development. Maybe it was necessary for these capitalists to develop and not to compete. But that's the problem for us as workers. This competition leads to wars and everything else.
Right, Christopher, sorry. Well, he's also spoken once, of course. You're on I think you've both only spoken once, I'm sure. So, you first.
Well, it's just that I wanted to repeat what Stan was saying, just simply add to what Stan was saying just now, that the dilemma remains. As Dick had put it quite rightly, that you can't support reformist movements of all these different kinds, because then you dissipate all your energies, right? But the point is that there is a fundamental ground under which, for instance, if you take the general strike of 1936, what would be the attitude of the Social Party? To wait and let them, you know, do nothing, enter into the situation. The fight, there is a kind of fight which actually declares itself. And you may end up by being on the, seeing that it has gone in the wrong direction, as it often does. But it could go in another direction, and it is the Socialist Party's choice to try to assist the movement to move towards more democracy, so that you can actually then begin to threaten the system itself, though it may seem to start like a merely reformist movement. That is a dilemma, surely.
Do you want to deal with that first, or shall I call Peter?
Carry on.
Peter?
Well, only briefly, Mr. Chairman. I'm just reminded about this subject that when all the East European economies of the economy in Russia went into self-destruct a few years ago, we had a job of holding meetings and writing stuff for the Standard and what have you, saying what our attitude was, and it presented no difficulty. We made it absolutely clear in all those meetings and in those articles in the Standard, leading editorials, that we supported the development of democracy in all those countries. And at the same time, we had absolutely no difficulty in dissociating ourselves from organisations that were solely interested in capitalist society. It really, there were other members who were involved in this, and we presented no difficulty at all. Just want to emphasise the point, no one would be left in any doubt, hearing what was said at those meetings and reading that stuff, that we supported the development of democracy in that.
John and then Steve, you both were almost sick. Did he? Okay. You know better than I do, can you?
Well, I'd like to remind you of some of the basic capitalist laws that we have to rely on in terms of, say, distributing yield. I was taken into custody in Chicago in, let's see, 1962-64, Well, the moment you call a lawyer from the Civil Liberties Union, we always had one on the number on hand. So immediately he'd come down to the police station and you were released. Cite the law and say, look here, you released this man. So there we are relying on basic capitalist laws, common law, in England, the right to assembly, the right to distribute, etc., etc. So that's the part of capitalist law we have to defend, because we're defending our own position in spreading the socialist message. So that part of it suits us, and it's certainly something the capitalists.
Okay, Steve?
Well, I mean, I think there's sort of three strategic issues in relation to this whole question of defending rights and how you think about it. One of them is the process of which particular rights you choose to select to fight about. I mean, if you go down that road, it's not just the Criminal Justice Bill, when it was a bill, it's now an act, that you have to look at. You've got to look at a number of others that are going at the same time, and you will immediately find yourself involved in all kinds of political fractures and tensions about which one you're going to go for. I mean, you know, there are quite a few people who would see themselves as being fairly progressive, who would look at the Criminal Justice Bill, which, for example, said that travellers can be moved on if they move into the back of your garden or the end of your road. But a lot of workers say, good! You know, that's all right. I don't regard that as one that I'm going to go. The defence of people's rights around so-called rape. You know, a lot of people say, either I don't care about it, or I do care about it, but not very much. But I'm more interested in something else. You'll get other people that say, well, look, what about the importance of holding back things like fox hunting, stopping fox hunting? And then you'll get other blood sports, and you'll get people who will say, well, those are the important ones in terms of the rights that you've got. So as soon as you do that, I mean, regardless, it's an issue of principle whether you do it or not, as Dick said, but regardless of whether you accept that issue of principle, those are the choices, that's the selection process you're going to have to go through. Secondly, what position the Socialist Party takes, or individual socialists take, is totally bloody irrelevant. Because if you're dealing with legislation and the legislative process, the only means that you have to affect the legislative process, the very limited means that you have, limited capacity, is your vote. And if you go along to politicians who are involved in legislation and say, we are going to withdraw our vote from you if you pass this legislation or don't pass that legislation, if enough people do that, that might have an effect on legislation. There are undoubtedly examples of when it does. And the Socialist Party is certainly not going to recommend that people do that in relation to any party capable of controlling legislation in this country or any other country, are we? We're not going to, for example, at the time when a criminal justice bill is being passed by the Conservative Party, say to the Conservative Party, if you continue to pass this, we're going to oppose it, because we already oppose it. Neither are you going to say, well, okay, if you oppose this bill, we're going to support you, because we're not. We'd need more than opposition to the Criminal Justice Bill to have any effect on our hostility to them. And furthermore, those suckers who did say to the Labour Party, you're the opponents of the Criminal Justice Bill, well, it's now 1999, 2 years, and the Labour Party has absolutely no intention, and bear in mind, the Home Secretary is a man called Jack Straw. There is no intention of getting rid of the Criminal Justice Bill. In fact, there is some talk about tightening some of the regulations in the Criminal Justice Bill, which Jack Straw was opposing when it went through. The third point, which you've got to consider strategically, is if you want to have a right, the best way is to establish the right and then let the capitalists work out the law. The right is what you should go for, not the law. Take the right of public speaking. You've got all kinds of rights of public speech, all kinds of things written down in law. But as far as having things written down in law, the only things that really count are ones that have been asserted in the